Welcome to As You Wish Talk Radio. I'm your host, James Gillen. We're broadcasting from the Self-Mastery Earth Institute, also home of East SETI, located at the base of majestic Mount Adams in beautiful Trout Lake, Washington. The land here is recognized by many sensitives and spiritual adepts as a vortex or power center, otherwise known as UFO or Paranormal Central. There's a lot more being broadcasted here tonight other than just words, so tune in to the energies and join us for an exciting journey. Tonight's guest is Dr. Nick Bajic, and let's see if we can bring Nick on.
I'm here.
Great.
All right. Well, it's good to be with you this evening.
Oh, great to have you with us. There's so much to talk about. I don't even know where to start. You have so many different fields you're working in. I guess the one of the first things I wanted to talk about was there's so many people concerned about the HEART Project.
Right.
And what's going on there? I guess they're getting ready to fire it up big time here in the very short near future.
Right. The facility has actually increased in size over the years. Right now, it's a large array or field of radio frequency antennas. They're about 72 feet tall and 180 in the array presently, and these actually focus radio frequency energy in a unique way that it can be then applied for weapons applications. Actually, the system on the ground through radio frequency energy can actually couple with an area above the Earth's surface known as the ionosphere and actually convert it to part of the machine or make it operate in harmony with the machine on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand that they're what's operating, I'm not sure, I think it was 1.6 gigawatts or something like that.
Right. The eventual power levels they want to be at is a gigawatt or greater, absolutely.
Yeah, I heard they're jumping it up to something like 3 or something, and then they're going up to 100. I don't know. It's something just incredibly outrageous.
Yeah, well, essentially, for the weapons effects that they were looking for, they needed 1 to 10 gigawatts, and a gigawatt is a billion watts of effective radiated power is what we're talking about, which
mm-hmm.
which is a complicated calculation to give you this kind of value, but it's a tremendous amount of energy. And what the idea is to manipulate that energy by firing or igniting each of those radio frequency antennas in a specific sequence that causes the energy to focus or concentrate. By analogy, it would be similar to what a laser does with light. You know, it actually concentrates or focuses the light energy into a relatively narrow beam, rather than let it spread out as normally would, you know. And so radio frequency follows the same kind of rules that light does. It spreads out very rapidly once you leave a transmitter, unless you can find a way to manipulate it so it sort of plays on itself. In this case, HARP produces what is called cyclotron resonance, which if you could visualize it, would look kind of like a corkscrewing sort of field of energy that got smaller and smaller as it went higher and higher. And the bigger the array is, the more focused or concentrated and the higher up you can go with this type of system.
Yeah, I know they're using it for ground-penetrating radar and things of that nature, but you're saying there's other weapons applications. Could you go deeper into that?
Yeah, there's actually a number. You know, for instance, for the ground-penetrating tomography, or as you described it, as a radar, it's very similar. In fact, what it does is, by sending energy up into the ionosphere, which is about 30 miles above the Earth's surface, you can pulse or pump that energy in such a way that the ionosphere begins to mirror or mimic that pumping action. Sort of acts like a big broadcast antenna in the sky, the ionosphere itself, sending energy back down to Earth in the ELF, extremely low frequency range, which readily penetrates the Earth and sea. And a certain amount of that reflected signal then can be read, and you get an imaging capacity for being able to look underneath the surface of the Earth several kilometers deep, well over a mile or two deep into the Earth. So pretty useful in that sense. The other applications, again, by manipulating that energy, you can create a cold plasma, which would be kind of like a wall of energy up in the ionosphere, except it could be tilted or moved like a mirror could in reflecting, you know, and how a mirror can reflect light. This plasma layer could reflect radio frequency to give you, for instance, over the horizon radar capability, being able to look around the curvature of the Earth for incoming objects, whether they be cruise missile heights or even intercontinental ballistic missiles would be able to detect those things coming in over the curvature of the Earth. You can also increase the power level and actually get a signature around those incoming objects that can be identified with gamma ray detectors mounted on, say, satellites to determine which ones of those objects were carrying nuclear payloads. In other words, you could sort out a number of things coming at you and figure out which ones were really the more serious threats for targeting purposes. And thirdly, in that kind of cluster of ideas, what the patents point to is the idea of creating even an electromagnetic pulse or a surge of energy sufficient to knock out the things that control the flight paths of those incoming objects, such as the onboard computers or avionics that control the flaps and wings and so on.
What about the there's a lot of strange occurrences where large flocks of birds just fell out of the sky and they seem to be barbecued and things of that nature. It does seem to be a possibility of it causing some kind of an effect where the energy would be very detrimental to anything underneath it.
Yeah, if something actually went through the beam at fairly close range, there's quite a bit of energy there, obviously. On a further distance where it gets involved in perhaps interfering with migration patterns and so on, because, you know, migratory species are said to orient towards magnetic field lines, and this system actually, in certain uses, will couple with those magnetic field lines that naturally surround the Earth and alter their character. And so there's a lot of concern that that alteration may, in fact, also alter migratory patterns or certainly have an impact on them. You know, the other things that come out in the literature deal with the idea that once you're manipulating the ionosphere, you can also control or manipulate communications globally, because the condition of the ionosphere is directly related to the conditions on the sun. In other words, big solar activity on the sun disturbs the ionosphere, which then in turn disturbs communications and even can disturb terrestrial power grids and telephone lines and those kinds of networks as well, if the disturbance is sufficient. So if you think about the HARP system on the ground being able to deliberately disturb the ionosphere and create those same effects, but because it's a controlled disturbance, the person using it could still carry their own communications on the very same system, denying everyone else access to theirs. So, you know, it's pretty versatile along those lines. The other things come out in the literature is the idea of manipulating weather systems. And this is kind of interesting. It's the idea of heating the ionosphere for an area about 30 miles in diameter, and then when you're able to do that, what happens is the ionosphere then lifts out. It would be like a column of 30 miles in diameter pushing out into space a couple hundred miles out, and what happens is the lower atmosphere moves in and fills that space, changing relative pressure systems, also perhaps diverting jet streams, which can be pretty profound in terms of the downstream effects. And, you know, why would they do that? I mean, that's kind of an odd thing to want to try and do. But the main reason wasn't so much weather mod, although that was kind of the after effect. It was a more being used for low-orbiting satellite as an anti-satellite technology, because those low-orbiting satellites, where there is no atmosphere, they're moving really at very, very rapid speeds. So if they encounter atmosphere, they create friction, and they actually will burn up and be destroyed. Mm-hmm. So if you could sort of push the atmosphere out there for just long enough to catch the flight path of a satellite, you'd be able to literally knock them out of the sky, turn the thing off, and everything goes back to normal.
Seems you could steer just about any kind of weather front you wanted. With that technology, you could move it anywhere you wanted on the planet.
Yeah, you've got about a, well, you could, you know, the technology's, you know, versatile enough to be moved. You can actually slew the beam that you have from any fixed location about 30 degrees, which gives you a lot of room, but moving a jet stream around on one end and sort of having a downstream effect even thousands of miles away is easily accomplished for this kind of system. The only thing is, it's not easily predicted. In other words, you could do it, but you don't know exactly what's going to happen. In other words, how far the swing will be or what it'll do to storm fronts. And here in Alaska, you know, back a number of years ago, people remember the situation in Orlando where a couple of tornadoes dropped in. And those tornadoes actually were caused in that unusual part of the country by shifts that occurred here in Alaska in the jet stream, coincidentally right above the HARP facility. where the jet stream moved north about 50 miles, then east about 75, then dropped back down south about 50 miles, and then moved on its route. And it moved storm fronts out of east Texas into central Florida, you know, all that distance, almost halfway across the country, and actually changed the conditions so they were able to get those tornadoes to form. And, you know, whether it was, you know, an accident or whether that's just a fluke of nature, it was interesting that it's exactly the kind of effect you could create by diverting the jet stream, even in a far-away
place. You could steer hurricanes or tornadoes or you know, we've had just crazy weather here. All the jet streams seem to have changed. And
they have.
Up in Washington, we're having bright, sunny weather and just incredible you know, beautiful days, and down in sunny California, they're just getting deluged.
Yeah, it's the jet streams are moving. A lot of that's driven by ocean temperatures, which are changing.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's not factored into that, you know, in terms of ocean temperatures, is the idea that you have at any given time, you know, undersea venting and volcanics taking place.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's just something we reported on back in 1997. And we accounted, you know, we suggest this probably accounts for more of the global warming syndrome and the dramatic changes in weather patterns, you know, because some areas are getting cooler, like Europe is getting cooler mainly because of fresh water coming off of Greenland now, you know, changing the salt conditions of the North Sea and then changing mm-hmm. the way currents flow. And the current engines of the oceans are driven by temperature, and when you start to look at those changes, you know, sunlight doesn't account for much of the temperature changes in this sense, is that the sunlight strikes the surface of the ocean and the heat is basically stays at the surface because as you get deeper, not very deep at all, the temperatures drop dramatically within the ocean. So most mm-hmm. of the heat from the sun stays at the surface. Ocean, or certainly heat, gets also trapped in the atmosphere, but when you think about oceans themselves, when volcanics release energy, or venting releases energy within the depths of the ocean, 100% of that energy is absorbed into the seas and then spreads out more or less like a plume as currents shifted around the planet. And that, you know, that makes more sense when you think of ocean temperature warming, mm-hmm. Because they were telling us, you know, 1 degree in 50 years, when reality is showing us something much different than that.
Oh yeah, what do you think about the possibility of these, we have these massive solar storms that are hitting the planet, and all those energies seem to be going in at the poles
into
the Earth, and maybe that's mm-hmm. what's generating the volcanoes and the earthquake activity, is the overheating of the Earth, the whole system on many different levels.
Well, the energy comes in, and what we know is that energy converts to mass at some level. I mean, that's Einstein's basic equation,
energy equals
mass squared. And, you know, this concept of the energy radiating from the Earth versus the energy coming in, there's a net amount that sticks around. Well, that converts to mass somewhere along the way. The idea that more energy is coming in, feeding the magnetic field lines that surround the planet, that changes the dynamic of the planet in some way. We really don't understand all of mm-hmm. that, you know, but we do know that when you think of the planet as a spinning motor with electromagnetic fields generated around it that can be mapped and have been, and then you change the energy state of that motor by changes on the things that feed it, in this case our sun, yes, it's going to have an effect. And so, you know, what you have right now is a disconnect between atmospheric physicists, volcanologists, or other kinds of earth scientists, atmospheric physicists, space scientists. You know, there's not a whole lot of talking between these groups to start to look at the Earth and the systems that feed it in terms of energy and what that energy is doing. They're not really connected very well. So the geologist isn't thinking about energy conversions on a real basic physics level. He's mm-hmm. thinking about, you know, earthquakes and volcanoes and, you know, and the geology of the planet, whereas, you know, everyone has their specialty to the point where we really can't see the big picture anymore.
Yeah, I had a theory back in, I actually wrote it in 82 in one of my books, and I talked about it. But my theory is that there's a pulse coming from galactic core and waves of energy coming in, and the Earth, our whole solar system is moving to a new place in the universe where there's a lot more energy, and that's why everything is glowing, you know, three times brighter, all the planets and everything else. And that energy affects the sun, which is the first thing that we can kind of measure or experience. And those massive coronal mass ejections and flares, when they're hitting the planet, it overheats the planet, and the energy goes in at the poles. which creates more earthquake and volcanic activity, which heats the ocean, and you know, you have the severe weather, and it's all a big cycle. But who knows where the cycle starts and ends? That's the hard part. I think everybody has a piece of the puzzle, like you're saying, of that cycle. And
right.
Until they all get together, they won't really understand the big picture.
Yeah, and I think, you know, with what we're seeing in all of these areas is extreme releases of energy that everybody would agree on, you know, I mean, on one level or another. And, you know, what those mean in the long run, there's lots of speculation, too, because, you know, no one's been around to make the observations, you know, long enough, you know, and record them in a way that we can understand them today. So, you know, and we all know, and we know now from, you know, ice cores and other, you know, other scientific samplings that these periods have come and gone before. You know, something that contributes to the whole engine that hasn't been well accounted for. We mentioned it in a video back that we produced on Earth changes, and this concept of methane release. You know, when in the Arctic regions, like where I am, you know, I'm in a subarctic region where permafrost exists from this point more or less all the way north, and permafrost are essentially areas of frozen ice lenses that cap the decay of huge peat bog areas scattered around the northern regions of the world, Siberia in particular. And what we have is warming actually causes methane, which is a greenhouse gas, which is 20 times more powerful than other man-made greenhouse gases. So your methane releases that are happening naturally now and accelerating with global warming are actually contributing at a really rapid rate. Last time it happened was 15,000 years ago when the ice age ended. So, and we never figured out where that methane came from, but maybe we're figuring it out now. You know?
Yeah, it seems to all be coming together. I've always told people that I think the Earth changes that we're going through right now are part of a grand cycle, but it's aggravated by man.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And here's the even a more important aspect of this is it's not even so much arguing the cause. I mean, because we'll do that. I mean, until you know forever. You know, certainly till this generation's long gone. But the point of the matter is the changes are occurring, and that cannot be denied. So it seems to me that the prudent approach is to analyze sort of what's happening, and then what do we do because of it? Because huge changes are going to happen agriculturally. I mean, like you talked about Seattle. Being sunny and clear, you know, instead of rainy and cloudy, as per what we thought was used to be normal anyway. You know, here in my part of the world, we have the same situation. I mean, I'm looking out my window at apple trees that when I was a kid, 40 years ago, we could not grow apple trees here and produce fruit. And now we can, you know, and it's as dramatic as the change from San Francisco to Seattle as it is from Seattle to South Central Alaska and Anchorage, and it's quite dramatic. I mean, we've seen the spruce die out here in massive numbers from over-infestation of spruce bark beetle, normally killed out with you know the normal super cold winters, but not happening now. And at the same time, we have a mite that's affecting birch trees in this part of the state, wiping them out, you know, not killing them, but, you know, damaging them every single year in increasing numbers.
Yeah, we're losing a lot of trees here just right at my ranch. We have a 70-acre ranch here, and it has a lot of ponderosa pine and other trees. And some of these trees have been around for God knows how long. I mean, they're massive trees, and they're just dying right and left. And I think partially it's because of the drought and also some of the, you know, all the weather changes that we're not getting those real hard freezes that killed off most of the parasites and the, you know, the bugs that would infest them.
Well, here's an interesting couple of papers I saw along this line is, you know, when you think about trees, particularly pine trees, where they have the needles that are a certain length, and those lengths correspond to the lengths of certain microwave transmissions in terms of their wavelength within the radio frequency range.
Mm-hmm.
And some have suggested even, and even with certain species of insects in terms of how they translate energy, you know, that in fact maybe it's some of these things that we've created that are weakening trees, and then insects of course act as the, you know, natural sort of decomposers, you know, of organic matter, so they just do their job and start multiplying in greater numbers as they register an abundance of sick plants. But when you start to look at all of the contributors, you know, we can sit here and argue about them, and a lot of people have spent their lives doing it, and unfortunately, it's not solving the problem. I mean, whether we're arguing about, you know, greenhouse gases being the cause or from human beings or whether it's from some other cause, the reality is that agricultural areas are disappearing and others are being created, and yet we're not keeping up. And the technologies for increased food production aren't being really exploited to the sense that, you know, we're following the same old models. We're getting stuck in the same old traps, or we're getting into some new traps that may breed and are, in fact, breeding unexpected problems.
Oh, yeah. It seems like there was a, I can't remember his name, but he was a botanist or something over, I think he was kind of a monk. And he pretty much proved that trees and fruits and vegetables that were grown organically and were much more pest resistant and healthy for the body and everything all the way through. He had all these different parameters. And then he was showing that a lot of the hybrid crops had to have the chemical fertilizers and the pesticides and everything else. They couldn't function otherwise.
Right.
And the life force in them was pretty much nil.
Yeah, there wasn't anything there. You know, here in a lot of it is the loss of trace. There's a couple things actually contributing. One of them is loss of trace elements. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
plants uptake trace elements a couple of different ways. One is, of course, through the roots that most of us understand, you know, small particles, colloidal particles, so fine they'll be able to be taken into the plant is one way. The other is not so well or often discussed is the idea that plants on the pores of their leaves actually will absorb colloidal materials, and these materials get laid down as dust during the course of the day, and then at night when the dew forms, that dust is kind of beaded up on those beads of dew, and in the morning when songbirds sing, those pores actually dilate on plants and absorb those nutrients through the leaves into the plant. And so when you think of things, all of the things that settle on plants now, it's not just the normal dust produced by the earth, which has all kinds of trace elements and useful nutrients that the soils deplete over time, but the dust blows nutrients around and tends to carry things around. So, but when you add in all of the things that human beings put in the picture, you know, we create essentially weakened plants. So, you know, I mean, when you start to look at the whole picture, here in Alaska, as an example, we grow vegetables in a place called the Matanuska Valley, which has got the world record for large vegetables. And people have said over the years, it's the sunlight. You know, we get so much sunlight here during the summer. I mean, right now we have 19 hours a day of daylight in my part of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that may account for some of it, but if that were just the only accounting, then Helsinki would have record vegetables as well, and so would all across Russia, and these aren't reported there. But if you look at what's going on in the area where these are grown, you have the confluence of two glacial till areas, which have huge volumes of colloidal minerals from the surface of the earth out of the Talkeetna mountain range. And then you have, from the Aleutian chain, from deep within the earth, colloidal minerals coming out in the form of volcanic dust settling in this region. And the wind shoots in that area keep it stirred up almost 365 days a year. So when you look at what's produced there, there's virtually no pesticides used. There's no fertilizers used, per se. And we produce huge vegetables of high sugar content and incredible nutrient values. Whereas if you compare the nutrient values of these vegetables to, say, those grown in exhausted fields in the lower 48 states, you see a much different nutrient content. In fact, the Food and USDA Department of Agriculture is actually, if you look at their reports beginning in the 50s and the 60s, 70s, and up to the current time, you'll see an average decrease of almost half relevant nutrient values in most vegetables produced in the lower 48 states, with the exception of carrots for some reason.
Yeah, we had a nice little fertilizer event here. We had Mount St. Helens go off.
Right. But it is. It's amazing because all of that material, as it gets mixed back into the environment, actually is a very potent type of fertilizer, and it's a natural fertilizer. There's a pulverized rock dust that's used for that purpose. That's there was a guy in whose son started using it. This guy was a nurseryman back in the Midwest, had over 400 trees growing.
Is that Rado Rock?
Yeah, it's the I forget the name now.
Yeah, we use that here. We use Raider Rock on. We do the Finhorn gardening here and just grow phenomenal food. We have orange trees growing up here.
Yeah, it's the same. You know, the same basic idea. You know, what you're doing is applying, essentially what nature's doing, but making sure it's available. And in this case, this kid was charged with growing so many trees in order to pay for his college education. So at 14, he's telling his dad, "I want to use rock dust," and his dad, the so-called professional, right, is saying, no, that's not a good idea. It's just a waste of time and money. And at the end of the first season, when the kid's trees, his whole acreage of trees was a foot taller than his dad's, you know, he took notice and the whole picture changed for him. But, you know, these are things that have been around a long time, and they're simple. And, you know, the nice thing is it's not only that you get pest-free because the plants are strong, but you also get a very vigorous plant because it's not being really weakened by its dependence on other nutrients. Because it's kind of like how humans are. You know, the reason we have so much obesity is largely related to our body's need for certain nutrients that we're not getting. So the body says, keep eating until you find them all, you know. And
yeah,
that's
a lot
really
of it,
the root of the problem. You know?
Yeah, I think corn syrup is probably the root of the problem. It's in everything. Your body doesn't really recognize it, and everybody just balloons out when you eat too much corn syrup. It messes up your thyroid as well.
Yeah, yeah. These are all contributing factors, you know, and when you think about it, your body has to have a certain level of material in order to be healthy, and the body doesn't really say stop looking until it's satisfied. And so it's really taking a look at what the structure of the food is that we're taking in and what's contributing to its growth and what actually we're ingesting in the system. Mm-hmm. You know, and when we really get into it, you know, I mean, all the things that we've been talking about tonight, we've crossed just already a bunch of things, have all dealt with the impacts of technology, which is fundamentally what we've been about the last 11 years, was sort of looking at technologies and starting to have maybe a little broader discussion, maybe a translation, you know, more importantly. Someone asked me the other day, you know, what do you do? And I think that's really characterizes it. We try and take science that has a tremendous potential impact, either for good or bad, and just getting it out there for a little bit more discussion before we start sort of committing ourselves to things that may, in fact, turn out to be really either one, depending on how we direct that technology. You know,
yeah, I know a lot of the GM foods right now, they're finding out that the geese and the mice and the wild animals won't even touch them. They won't even eat it, you know. So they're trying to tell us something there.
Well, I think, too, nature recognizes things on a different level, you know, and, mm-hmm. and I think that's a clue for us. You know, the way that we've decided as human beings, they say, to figure out what was edible was watch what the animals ate and didn't die from, you know.
Yeah,
there's a lot to be said for that.
You know, they cured cancer. This one guy cured cancer that way. He just followed his horse around. His horse had cancer, and he followed his horse around and watched what he ate. He started picking all the different herbs and plants that the horse was eating and started brewing them up in the tea and took it, and his cancer went. The horse's cancer went away, and his cancer went away as well.
That's interesting. Yeah, you know, and who knows? I mean, there's a lot out there. I know that the observation of what happened on the pores of plants was made by a guy named Dan Carlson. You may have read about or heard
mm-hmm.
about. And you know, he actually used it in a farm application that's been used all over the world. And you know, the thing that was interesting is he did his sort of intuitively. There was a physicist at Princeton that had the same kind of idea that in this case, Dan Carlson was using sound to replicate what birds do. What he didn't realize is, and he realized it sort of after the fact, because it really changed not only the growth of the plant, but the plant's offspring changed. And I'll give you an example. When I visited his farm in Wisconsin, if you think about a beech tree, they grow in these... as they grow vertical height, they get a branch cluster for each year,
mm-hmm.
and these are generally about 10 inches to 12 inches apart. Excuse me, an elm tree I'm thinking of. And they're about 10 inches apart. They're a five-branch cluster, and they represent a year of vertical growth. And when you looked at when he owned this farm, you know, from the years that he had it, you counted down 13 years from the very top of the tree, branch clusters, you got to where he purchased this farm, and everything below that was 10 inches or 12 inches or so between clusters. Everything above it, after he bought this farm and began to apply his concept, was 3 to 4 feet of vertical growth.
Wow. Wow.
And when you looked at the offspring of that elm tree, the elm tree leaf, you might take your middle and index finger and put them together, and stretching down, you might get an elm leaf, you know, in terms of size. And the offspring from the tree, like 7 years old offspring from this tree, the leaf was actually the size of your whole hand. And
mm-hmm.
it was, you know, Carlson didn't realize it, but the physicist at Princeton who actually looked at this realized that sound in certain sequences altered the way proteins acted and really changed the way in which plants grew. So he was able to stimulate
mm-hmm.
plants by tuning a series of notes to frequencies that would interact with the proteins that compose that specific plant.
I'll tell you a little story on the wild side on that. We had this place up here is really well documented. It has about a 100-year history of UFO activity. But we had two trees, and one was an aspen and one was a cottonwood. And this UFO, we took pictures of this UFO hovering over this tree. And then the next year, the leaves on that tree were probably 30 times bigger than the other aspen and cottonwoods. And we picked the leaves off this tree, and they were just enormous. It looked like some kind of a tropical plant. So there was some kind of an interface between the fields of that ship and the tree itself. And we actually picked them and did a lot of investigation on them, you know, and checked this out. So there's some kind of an application there. I don't know how that would work, but somehow either the magnetic frequencies or the pulses coming from the ship or something actually affect plant growth.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, there's quite a bit on this subject out there over the years. We've seen, you know, a lot of references to this kind of material. And you know, essentially, if you start to think about physical matter, underlying that is our atoms, and underlying, you know, those atoms are essentially space and particles flying around at, you know, mm-hmm. at incredible velocities. You know, in other words, there's energy in motion happening all the time in every substance. And when you add energy in or take energy out, you alter the state of the matter that manifests from that. And so, you know, when you start to think about energy as it's being applied, and you started out the conversation with HARP, and you know HARP mm-hmm. is a huge system that can be applied to affecting the environment, but also affecting chemistry specifically within any living organism, depending on how you manipulate that energy. You know, you can think about it almost like you think about a radio broadcast. You know, the energy coming off of that broadcast, you know, most of that energy is dissipated with distance, and most of it, when you dial through the stations, you know, you get static between the stations. But when you mm-hmm. get resonance or harmony between the transmitter and the receiver, you get a nice clear signal and you hear the music. Well, this is the same analogy for the human body. Every cell, every gross organ, the entire body itself, or even atoms or molecules within the body have related harmonic or resonant frequencies that will stimulate them, that will cause them to do more than they'll do on their own in terms of energy exchanges. And so when you start to think about energy, think about it in that same frame, that if you start to manipulate the energy, then you can create very different effects. And that's what, you know, what much of the science today is about. It's about how to manipulate both for ill and for good
mm-hmm.
living organisms energetically. And there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, you think about climate change and the impacts on food production, anything that we can do that might enhance that and enhance food quality, all of those things are definitely good things.
Yeah, unfortunately, it seems like the military industry is the big funders in all of these programs.
Yep.
And we know where the use goes in that application. And it's too bad they don't have some major oversight committee to just, you know, have the hammer and sit there and really look into all of these things and say, okay, this one's beneficial, this is dangerous, this is going to affect things on subtle levels, which is going to create a physical impact that we don't know about yet, so we're going to put this on hold. Or
sure, you know, and theoretically, those groups exist. Unfortunately, the theory and the reality don't match up. You know, we have oversight technology and military oversight committees within the Congress. The problem is, and I had an interesting discussion. I had a discussion with a reporter a few just a few days ago, actually, discussing the impact of technology. And then the question was, you know, why isn't the government more involved? Why aren't the oversight committees more involved? And I said to the reporter, look, I said that to really get to an issue, to get to a story, and you know this as a reporter, I said you need to ask the questions, and those questions that you ask have to be based on some foundation of knowledge to get past the initial layers. I mean, to get down into the deep ideas that might be trying to be expressed or suppressed, you got to ask the right questions. And who in the Congress has the science background across disciplines within those committees to ask the right questions? Mm-hmm. There are a few, but there's not enough. And unfortunately, the wall between policymakers and military planners has gotten more intense, not because of necessarily the mechanisms not being there, but the intelligence to interpret what's there, ask the right questions. And quite frankly, the bureaucracy has become so big, a lot is hidden, even from those that fund these projects.
Yeah, they're not even going to, even if you ask the right questions and you have the answers, and if they don't like the answers, then it's going to interfere with their project or their pocketbook. You know, it's just going to be dismissed, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I think there's a lot more possibilities, because what has happened with technology is people are quickly realizing that it's, you know, there's a lot of nice things and nice possibilities, but at the same time, there's a lot of misuse. And it's that misuse that really is starting to trigger the consciousness of people to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we're spending huge, vast sums of money, but these basic concepts that we're learning about in terms of our health and our physiology are all actually the keys to resolving many of our problems. So, you know, I think the veil starts to get removed. The other thing that happens is science isn't exclusive to militaries. You know, the way things operate today, anyone could be the inventor of the next great technology, and as a consequence, it's flattened out quite a bit. So, you know, what I look forward to is where you start to see countries that have greater interest than our own, perhaps, to develop some of these alternatives, see those alternatives developed, whether it be in the energy areas or the health areas, and we're already seeing that. In certain parts of the world, health practice and modalities for treatment have been used for decades, just now being introduced in the U.S. Just simple examples are artificial discs that have been used since 1984 in Germany, which is certainly not a third world country, but in fact a first world country in terms of technology. You know, we're just now introducing that in the U.S. 20 years, two decades later. The same is true with other forms of therapy, whether it be acupuncture, finally acknowledged for pain treatments and other treatments in the U.S. after decades of ignorance. And in fact, and if you really look at acupuncture, millennium of ignorance, you know.
Yeah. Well, they have other, you know, the Rife technology and all these things are still pretty much censored, but, you know, they show pretty phenomenal effects on any kind of virus or bacteria or things that are harmful to the body. They just zap them, you know, on.
Well, there's, you know, those are exactly the kinds of technologies that are being rediscovered and brought back. I mean, in Europe, in Finland, for instance, they're using a method of electrolaser acupuncture that, you know, was challenged by their medical authorities all the way up to their highest court. And the inventor of that technology, a good friend of mine up until his passing a few years ago, actually won his case, was able to train 15 clinicians before he died because he had had 16,000 case studies to support his claims.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these were healing things like multiple sclerosis, diabetes, certain kinds of cancers. And when people say they got a cure for cancer, there's about 700 varieties. So there's a lot of qualification there. But nonetheless, he had great success in a number of instances with what were theoretically incurable. And it was using essentially a mediated energy through the acupuncture system of the body. And this whole concept actually is described in a DVD along with a lot of other material we produced a while back that really gets into this, the ideas of you know, physically manipulating the body using energy itself. And, you know, when you think of acupuncture, that's essentially what it is, electroacupuncture or electrolaser acupuncture using electrons and photons for manipulating energy is also an interesting application. That has been very, very successful. And not just Finland, but many parts of the world now use one or the other or both of those modalities.
Yeah, I worked with a biophysicist for about 6 years from Germany, and he's got about 9 degrees. He's a nuclear physicist, too. And he actually crystallized oxygen and stabilizes it at room temperature, and he suspends it in a microhydrant. And if you put an oximeter on your finger and drink this water, your oxygen levels just peg at about 100%. It's amazing. You know, around 98, 100%. And almost all the pathogens are anaerobic, you know, the viruses and bacteria that are harmful to the body, and cancer cells are anaerobic as well. So this jumps your blood oxygen up, and also it raises your pH as well.
Right.
And Otto Warburg gave us the cure for cancer in 1927, I think. He's at least a double, maybe even a triple Nobel Prize winner. And what he said was, all you have to do is raise the body pH and increase the blood oxygen.
Yep.
And, you know, cancer can exist, or the pathogens as well.
Right. We actually, there's a mushroom hybrid, cordyceps. You might be familiar with this one.
I am.
And this actually will increase oxygen by about 28% uptake in the body when it's hybridized and prepared properly. There's other things that, you know, you can do in terms of changing pH, and all of those things, as you say, is kind of setting the right background for the body to handle itself properly. And pH, in terms of water, even, you know, in Alaska, in my part of the world where we have really good glacial-fed water, it's almost neutral. You know, it's almost right on the money. Maybe just slightly alkaline, which is excellent, you know, for natural water.
That's what we have here too. Our water comes straight off a glacier and goes underground and then comes back up again, and that's our city water here in our little town of Trout Lake.
Right. You know, and that's how we are here in Anchorage. You know, we have this incredible water out of Eklutna Lake, essentially glacial fed.
Yeah, and people have these big glass bottles of water in their house, and I go, see that? That's our bath water.
Right.
No, that's the way everybody should live.
That's right. You know, the interesting thing, you know, about all of this is, you know, there's some great, the Internet, as an example, what we're doing today, you know, being able to talk about a lot of information, you know, people can go and dig that information out like never before. And that's, I think, where the hope is in a lot of this, is because there is this larger network of people discussing these and other issues, that there's a huge, huge interest in sort of feeding the fire of alternative technologies. And I think more individuals are going to be, you know, putting effort in that direction, and already are, in a manner that maybe bypasses the old military-industrial models that would inhibit development or stifle innovation, and, you know, when it was determined that perhaps it would serve a military interest before a human interest. And that's happened many, many times in the development of technology. And I think that's where many really brilliant scientists are kind of saying, hey, you know, there's other ways to use this knowledge, and maybe we need to start applying it to solutions rather than, you know, continuing to aggravate communities that really thrive on fear and paranoia. And I think that's where the military is. And, you know, and that's their job. I mean, that's not to say they shouldn't do that. That's their job. But policy in the direction of countries is determined by the civilian sector, and that's our job.
Exactly.
And so it's that combination that can make things work a little bit differently than they have been.
Yeah. Speaking of the Internet, I believe your website's earthpulse.com.
Yeah, that's correct, earthpulse.com, and we also have a research site, and layinstitute.org, layinstitute.org, is where we're starting to post our research materials as well as our archives, so that will be a useful site for people to look at. And then the earthpulse.com site is our commercial site that carries all of our videos, books, and other materials that we've produced over the years.
I think you have Angels Don't Play That Harp, and the Earth Rising series, and Harp DVD, and Earth Change DVD on there.
Right, and we have other other materials from other authors and other things that we've produced, and a number of pieces of hardware and equipment that we've liked and that we utilize. But again, you know, the idea of a lot of this is a double-edged sword, you know, and the question is, when technology, which is today, you know, technology that we have right now that was invented starting with the wheel to where we are right now, will double every 9 to 10 months. And at that rate, there needs to be a little more discussion about the impacts of some of these technologies, and that's the niche that we're trying to fill. And we think there's room for a whole lot of people to start breaking down and analyzing the science. And the Lay Institute site is a place for us to put that, that which we find. And we've loaded 700 summations of documents on that site, and we have a couple thousand more that we'll load within the next few months. And these are bits of information that add to the debate, that give credibility to this kind of discussion, because they point to the academic studies, military reports, mainstream media reports, but in a much simplified, reachable search engine, and primarily technology-related impacts as well as climate change.
I've had the opportunity to meet a lot of top physicists, and for some reason they just trust me. They show me everything. And, I've seen counter-gravity devices, energy-generating devices that are just phenomenal, put out phenomenal output, zero-point energy technologies, and, miracle healing technologies. But, all these guys are just sitting there saying, there's no way I can bring this out now, not with the present administration and the way, the powers that be are right now. And they're right. A lot of them have disappeared by doing that very thing.
Well, here's sort of my take on it, is I think if people really have these technologies in their hand, that the only way that they can ensure themselves of getting them out is to do what they ought to be doing with their creative effort in the first place, is get it out there to the public in a manner that maybe doesn't bring them an immediate reward.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something to be said, for what happens when there's the next breakthrough in technology. Maybe you don't make the $1 billion that you're envisioning, but you create such a dramatic change. I think you can, in fact, introduce technologies if you're willing to take those kinds of risks and not fall into the same models others have. As soon as you file the patents, you're dead, or your patent is confiscated.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to develop that technology, it's going to have to be given out, and it's going to have to be given out in a way that maybe generates you a revenue stream, maybe it doesn't. This is where I think government could play even the opposite role that it's been playing, is by providing incentives and ways so that if people develop intellectual property that serves humankind's interest, that it has to be produced. It cannot be suppressed. And then it's done on a licensing basis where the inventor receives their royalty no matter who uses it, but everybody's encouraged to use it, because a good technology that changes things for humanity ought to be encouraged, not discouraged. And so,
yeah, I think there needs to be some kind of legislation for that, as well as penalties for anybody that suppresses this kind
criminal penalties.
Oh, exactly.
Jail sentences. Yeah, exactly right. And where you start losing your civil rights along the line, when you start messing with humanity's right to be free of the burden of some of the things that inflict suffering, and that's really what we're talking about.
Exactly.
And I think that's, again, the opportunity to present really good science. And I think there's some alternatives coming. There may be some alternative sources to get issues out. One of the things that we had pitched to the European Parliament before we saw one of our, great allies knocked out in a controversy, the same kind of thing that generally happens to these guys, was to put together an international whistleblowers mechanism that would allow for people, either in corporations or government, to have that impartial way to sort of bring things forward that needed to be in the front of humankind as a debatable issue. These
mm-hmm.
kinds of super technologies, whether held by corporations or held by militaries, and that good incentives be provided in that whistleblowing mechanism to give people the security to come forward in a way that maybe an ombudsman of some kind that they could trust could actually bring it all forward. And, there's a lot of areas. If you look at the United States, all the problems that people point to, it's really a secrecy syndrome that's created many of these problems and
mm-hmm.
the lack of an open and transparent government. And that's, been drawn out of the paranoia that came in the Cold War and after World War II. And yes, the technologies we have now are way more powerful than whatever we had back then. But the reality today is these technologies are going to continue to advance at very rapid rates. Someone else besides us is going to have them. Right now, we may feel like we're on top of the world. And, when you look at military expenditures, we spend more than all the other industrialized countries combined.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so you take our military spending compared to China's, and China's spending one-tenth of what we're spending. The difference, though, is people aren't considering purchasing power, and in China, you get 10 times more for the dollar than you do in the U.S.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's not how much you spend, it's how much you produce.
Exactly.
And this is the relevant factor, and out of a billion brains instead of 300 million brains or 2 billion brains in China, who do you think is going to develop the biggest percentage or the biggest number of geniuses? And it's going to be China, just based on raw statistics. And in a centralized government, that genius is going to get funneled wherever the government wants it to go, whether it's to build industrial capacity that eventually can be converted to produce anything they want, not just umbrellas and computer chips. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, it's about that. Ultimately, it's an ideology, a philosophy, or if you really want to look at it, what drives our technology is our underlying view of the world. And when you have multinational corporations that have no soul and no consciousness driving the Western side of the equation, and you have a philosophy of collectivism and the denial of the individual, then you've got some real conflicts coming.
Yeah, that's what we keep seeing here over and over again. That I just wrote an article about that, actually. It's called That Corporations Have No Soul, you know. And it just talks about how profit is just first priority. And, you know,
well,
it doesn't matter if it's at the expense of humanity and the earth. It's just, you know, they're just going after that profit. And unfortunately, that I think the biggest plague we have on the planet, it has two parts to it. One is the concept of separation, which, you know, people actually think they're separate from each other and the rest of the planet and, you know, the environment. And the other one is greed.
Yeah, you know, there's maybe a third leg to that that I'd throw in there, and that's interference, you know, and with other people's right to self-determination.
Exactly,
because,
yeah.
You know, we're out there, our corporations and corporate interests are out there thinking everybody needs McDonald's and MTV, and the fact of the matter is they don't. You know, a lot of, you know, we need to start to learn how to leave people alone. And not
we don't even have TV
their...
up here. We're out in the middle of nowhere, and I refuse to get a satellite dish.
But, I mean, in terms of, you know, when you think about it, we get into these places where people are economically, from our eyes, they look poor and miserable. But in reality, if you observe what's going on, within people's cultural context, they're both happy and maybe economically, from our perspective, from our eyes, on a different economic system than we are entirely. So what we do is we go into these areas and we tend to create urban centers, and these urban centers take and put people that are essentially rural into urban environments where now they are truly miserable and poor, versus being just economically poor in our sense, but perhaps very rich economically in their own. But it's, you know, it's in that context that we sort of reorganized the world and continue to do it. A few years ago, I was in a conference in Istanbul sponsored by Bartholomew the First. He's a patriarch of the Orthodox Church there. And you know, in this discussion was over environment and poverty and the sort of the implications of all that. You know, and it's interesting is that, you know, when you take it in that context and you leave people, have a sort of a leave-alone view, they're neither poor nor miserable, and then there's not the unrest that generates what become the wars that we fought over the last few thousand years. And if you really analyze it, it's about the imposition of other people's values and ideas on folks that just flat don't want them. And now you have corporations, as you say, soulless. Maybe when their founders were around and they had the character of the founder embedded in them, it was one thing, but that disappears in a generation or two, and you get a corporation driven by only one thing, and it's Wall Street. It's the bottom line, and that formulates all of the negative things that human beings can be responsible for just as much as a lot of other emotions. And so balancing that, again, with a kind of a conscious ethic is where it begins, and where it ends is really the application technology. Whether the plane delivers passengers to, you know, to their favorite resort location or bombs to their best target, depends on what's going on with the operator and the intentions behind it. And so when we start to think about some of these new technologies that are advancing, the same applies, except, you know, we have the ability to maybe destroy ourselves while we're trying to play it out, figure it out. And that's, you know, that's where issues like HARP become very important for discussion. Not just for military planners, but for the public at large. These other technology areas that we've touched on certainly have that same requirement. And there's a lot of areas we've not even touched on tonight that maybe we'll cover another evening.
Oh, yeah, we'll definitely have you on again. You know, I kind of feel like people should really take stock in their life and their world and just see how much love and joy and unity they have with themselves and their neighbor and their family, and really see if the path they've chosen is working for them, because sometimes just the stress involved in, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and all the other things that, you know, this life we've created for ourselves is it's actually deadly, you know, it's physically deadly. To put all that stress on you, and that's what I see. The more you slow down, the closer you get back in touch with nature and shift into service mode, the more, you know, love and joy and peace you have within yourself, and it seems to be the path other than one most of humanity seems to have chosen right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, just the environments we're in, it creates stress, and if you look at what's going on, you know, in those situations, a lot of worry, a lot of fear, you know, a lot of things that, if you even look at an EEG, look at what the brain's doing in those states, you'll see incoherent brain patterns, the kind that don't lend themselves to good thinking, to meditation, mm-hmm. to awakened states of creativity, to solving problems, to being in the right frame of mind to even solve problems. I mean, you do the flight or fight thing real well when you're in those states, but that doesn't work in a modern culture. And so when you're experiencing, you know, calm, and you're experiencing a focus and a confidence, it's expressed in any of the positive emotions, love, empathy, you know, these kinds of things actually produce coherent brainwave signals that indicate the kind of clarity of mind that's necessary for good creative processes and problem solving.
Yeah,
and that's a matter
like
of science. I mean, it's not a matter of speculation.
Oh, yeah. That's
just the way it works.
Sounds like a whole other show I'd like to get into is the, you know, the mind control and the frequencies and everything.
Well, we'll do that for sure, because that's probably, at least from my perspective, those areas of technology, the most exciting and the most interesting. Mm-hmm. Did we send you a DVD on that issue?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen the DVD on that one. I've heard you talk several times.
Yeah, we'll try and get that one down to you, you know,
over
the next few weeks. And, you know, that whole topic is actually the topic of a book. We're just in the final stages of getting it off to the printer. It'll be out in about 6 to 8 weeks. And it's on that very subject. We have over 300 citations sort of tracing the history from the 1920s to the present frame of this technology. And then the last half of that deals with the application of technologies in maybe a more positive way for enhancing human performance. So another night we'll have to definitely cover that.
Yeah, we're definitely out of time here, so I wish we could go on forever on this. But go ahead and send me that information, and when you get your new book out, I'll definitely put it out over my email list.
That sounds great.
Promote that, and I can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, and we'll do it again soon.
Great. Sounds great. We have a great night.
Thanks. Take care now.
Good night, Nick.
Bye.
That's James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio, and have a great evening.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.